After the news broke of this evening's explosions in both Dublin and Monaghan, the Taoiseach remained in his office, keeping in touch with the situation. He had consultations with his Minister for Justice and the Minister for Defence, and there was a full government meeting. Afterwards, Mr Cosgrave recorded this statement.
The government and I wish to express our profound sympathy to the relatives of the victims of today's outrages and to those who have been injured and maimed. To the evil men who have perpetrated these deeds, we express the revulsion and condemnation which every decent person in this island feels at their unforgivable acts. The government are as yet unaware of the identity of those responsible for these crimes, but everyone who has practiced violence or preached violence or condoned violence must bear a share of responsibility for today's outrages.
An apprentice tailor at the time, back in May 1974. I liked it. I loved it, you know. I was really good at it. Unfortunately, that day, that was the end of my tailoring career as such.
Lives changed forever on May 17th, 1974. 15-year-old Noel Hegarty planned to meet his sister on Talbot Street. Instead, he walked straight into one of the bombs.
Remember a flash and a puff of smoke, and that was it. I don't remember waking up in the hospital, and I was being anointed, and I think it was 3 days later before my father and my eldest brother actually found me. So I wouldn't have had any identification on me at the time. Practically all my life attending hospitals. But it was a horrible day, horrible day. Just horrible. I had this buzzing sound in my ears all the time, just constant. But I presume later, later in life, that I realised my eardrums were perforated. So, I always remember a terrible smell, a stench afterwards. I just couldn't get rid of it. It was like, it was like sulphur or burning. It was horrible, a horrible smell. But, I have pictures in my mind and I don't know where these pictures came from, you know. You can see people, bodies, blood everywhere. And I always remember the sound of glass, just shards, just as though somebody had dumped a load of glass on the ground. It was just shh. And I know that affected me for years afterwards, because if I heard the sound of breaking glass, it just go ballistic. Or the sound of a car door banging, you know, became very, very nervous and frightened, scared. Prayed that another car bomb would go off. Stayed with me for I won't say it has gone away, because it is still there, you know. Certain noises that trigger things, and when you hear them, you know, you jump. But you realise, like, you know, it's not going to happen. But it still has an effect on you.
Noel Hegarty is among the roughly 300 who suffered injuries in the Dublin-Monaghan bombings. And 50 years on, the mental scars remain.
I became very suicidal after it. Very withdrawn, and I don't think I've ever got over it. I never will, you know. I was only a teenager at the time, starting out in life, and I didn't have the tools to deal with what arose and what was the aftermath. Just the only way I could deal with it was, you know, either take an overdose or, you know, try and kill myself. I ended up in Port Rand then. And I suppose, you know, their answer to it was electric shock treatment, you know, so. I had 12 courses of that, one after the other. They say you're only supposed to get 6 of them, but I got 12. Doesn't make you forget. Makes things a lot worse. It did for me anyway. And I could never trust the doctor after that. Just medical professions were. I was lost. Yeah, my teenage years were spent in and out of the hospital and, you know, being treated as though I did something wrong, you know. Being made feel guilty. You know, I drank a lot back then. And I always remember being stopped by a guard one night. And he asked me, why was I drinking so heavy? So I tried to explain to him that trying to deal with things because of the bombings. And his answer to me was, well, you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, weren't you? You know? And that's an authority figure. So, you know. It was hard. Well, I was unlucky. I met my wife, Fran, and she's my rock. I'd be lost without her.
I know in 1998, the bombing in Tyrone in Omagh had a major impact on you as well, didn't it?
It did, yeah. Yeah. Tried to commit suicide again. But I'm lucky that I have a family around me that look after me. They're always there for me. Sometimes I feel as though I've let them down by the things that have happened over the years.
Four people perish in the bombings, including an unborn baby. And for others, thoughts of that day simply proved too much.
We didn't know Anna was in the bombs until the following evening at 7 o'clock.
The only family photo of Anna O'Brien, her husband John, 17-month-old Jacqueline and 5-month-old Anne-Marie is one of two adult coffins flanking two small white caskets, a painful reminder for Anna's sister Alice.
And the only reason how we knew she was in the bombs, my father went into town that day because my auntie across the road, Chrissy, said she didn't hear from her all night. So they went down to the mortuary to see were they in it, and she was in it. Because Chrissy identified her by an earrings, the earrings she gave her. Although my father couldn't identify her because it was too bad. The scenes in the morgue was unbelievable. He said it was like a slaughterhouse. He said you were putting legs and arms together to make a body. So God knows what was in them coffins. Johnny had a tattoo up here on his arm, and it had his name and Anna's name on it. And then Anna had the earrings on Anna, but Anna lost legs and arms. Do you know that way? They really got the blunt of it, you know.
Tiny little sandals, half the size of my hand.
Catherine, another of Anna's sisters, shows us a pair of sandals.
And they're navy and red and cream, with the dirt still on them. And they were on Jacqueline the day before she died. And there's also a little spot of yellow paint. And what kid doesn't get paint on their clothes, you know? So I treasure these, the little writing is still on them. And it just makes me feel closer to them that I have them.
And,
yeah.
And looking at them now, they're so small.
They're tiny.
The two girls were so young, they hadn't even begun life yet.
No, these were Jacqueline's, so... The week before the bombings, they were in Temple Street Hospital with Anne-Marie, which is the new baby, because she had click hips. And they were to go in the week after, and they didn't turn up because they were all gone. They were scattered. And then that alone was horrible for us, but Ma wasn't the same for 9 years after.
It wasn't until the Saturday that he had Anna and Johnny and two children in there that they discovered this could be a family. Do you know that way? That's it. And my mother was, she might as well died on the day because that was the end of her. Because when you look at it too, our eldest daughter and the only grandchildren, do you know that way? She never got over that. For 9 years she lived after that, but she never got over it. I think my mother was 43 when Anna died.
Like, I don't remember good times after. I don't remember any good Christmas after. What got me through these years is Anna, John, Jacqueline and Anne-Marie are together up in heaven as a family, and the way they should have been down here. But that's what gets me through. And I'm 56 now, and I was 6 when it happened. And that's what gets me through.
Grieving families, they were left alone to pick up the pieces in the days, months, years and decades after.
Do you know, for nearly 6 months to a year after that, we were really still sort of in denial a little bit. I know it sounds naive to say this, but we always sort of expected it was a mistake, or maybe Siobhan would come in and Mam was saying, I wonder would Siobhan be home today. That it took a while for it to actually sink in, because for your daughter or your sister to be killed in a bomb explosion, I mean, it was just beyond our comprehension. It really was.
Wexford's Aileen and Liz Royce lost their 19-year-old sister, Siobhan, in the Talbot Street bomb.
She was so happy and carefree, and life was... She was just on this new path of her life and settling into Dublin, and had obviously had a good career ahead of her. And then for this to happen, and she was just gone in an instant, that it was just... heartbreaking, it really was.
And as a family, like I'm sure all the other families would say, you were expected just to carry on. There was absolutely no intervention, no support system,
counseling.
no inquiry to see how you were coping. So it was basically down to you as a family to be able to deal with the grief and the loss and the trauma. And I have to say, only the fact that we had fabulous parents who, I think it was due to their strength that got us through everything, because they had to really find courage to continue. And I think it's a testimony to them that we were just such a close family that we were able to get through it somewhat, but to learn to deal with it, you know. And I think that's one thing that, you know, we could have gone another direction. But
they had to dig deep.
they had to dig deep. We had to support them. And over the years, they never, ever, till their last, I'd say, breath, Siobhan was always spoken about. She was always in the moment, you know.
And even in the latter years, Mam was in her late 70s when she began to have little signs of dementia. And then the time came to go into a nursing home. Now, what I'm coming to is, now at this stage, Mam really had Alzheimer's. But still in that moment of lucidity, she would break her heart crying about Siobhan. Now, everything else was probably gone, but Siobhan was always in her mind.
But why were so many lives changed that normal Friday evening? Why target Dublin and Monaghan?
What were the perpetrators trying to achieve out of the deadliest massacre in the history of this island?
Well, the state had been shaken to its core by the outbreak of the Troubles in the north from August 69 onwards. And really, for a period up till 1972, there was almost universal sympathy in the south with Northern Nationalists.
Brian Hanley is a historian of 20th century Ireland at Trinity College, Dublin.
By the summer of 1972, a lot of that solidarity is being replaced by worry, by a feeling that the Troubles are spreading south, by a feeling that the state itself is somehow being threatened by the violence in the north. And much of that came to a head in December 1972.
Two car bombs in Dublin city centre in December 72 killed 23-year-old Thomas Duffy and 30-year-old George Bradshaw. A few weeks later, another car bomb exploded, killing 25-year-old Thomas Douglas. Both attacks believed to have been carried out by loyalist paramilitaries. Things were heating up on both sides of the border.
The British government and the new Irish government, which was a Fine Gael Labour coalition, were really struggling to come up with some way that would stabilise Northern Ireland. And the British were, you know, prepared to set up a power-sharing assembly in the north if they could get enough unionists and nationalists to agree to work it. And this would have a role for Dublin as well. That role was, again, pretty unclear, but from the very beginning, it's rejected almost entirely by most unionists. So from the extremes of the UDA and the UVF, but also people like Ian Paisley's DUP, a big chunk of the official unionists as well are opposed to this Dublin dimension. They see it as the road to United Ireland.
The beginning of 74 seemed to introduce something positive. For the first time, we had power sharing arising out of the arrangements that had been agreed at Sunningdale in December 73.
Former Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Sean Donlan. He was head of the Northern Ireland Division at the time of the bombings.
A power-sharing executive was created in Northern Ireland. It took office on the 1st of January 1974, but in fact, as soon as the executive took office, two paramilitary organisations, the IRA on the one hand and the UVF on the other, declared their total opposition to the new power-sharing arrangements and made it clear they were going to do everything possible to bring down the new arrangements. And at the same time, the government in Dublin, advised obviously by the Gardaí, had come to the view that there was a threat to the democratic institutions in the Republic, and that that threat included a threat to the lives of ministers and other senior politicians.
By May 74, hostility grew, with loyalist paramilitaries, including the UVF Ulster Volunteer Force, intensifying their efforts to collapse power sharing.
The most important unionist response to Sunningdale was a general strike in May 1974. And this was really a coalition between loyalist paramilitaries, loyalist trade unionists, some of them in key positions in power stations and in other industries in the north. And they ultimately called a general strike, which started to bring Northern Ireland to a halt. But once the loyalists began to set up barricades, began to threaten people, that accelerated the success of the strike. It's also very clear that the British Army made a decision that they did not want to fight on two fronts, and they were not going to intervene in a major way against the Loyalist barricades or against the strikers. So that meant that the Loyalists had an advantage in terms of being able to shut down large parts of the north. The strike was, in the end, stunningly successful because it destroyed power sharing. In the midst of that strike, just a few days in, you have the carnage in Dublin.
So the atmosphere generally, the change of government in Britain, headed by Harold Wilson, a politician who was not generally trusted by the government in Dublin. So you had the uncertainty from the London side, and of course you had the experimental power sharing in Northern Ireland not yet bedded in. It became clear when papers were released 20 years later in the early 1990s, it became clear that Wilson had decided as soon as he became Prime Minister to look seriously at the possibility of total British withdrawal from Northern Ireland in every way, financially, legally, constitutionally, militarily. As the years have gone on, my view that collusion was involved became more, it became stronger, mainly because I began to learn much more about what was Harold Wilson's approach when he became Prime Minister in February of 1974. If his approach was as radical as considering complete British withdrawal from Northern Ireland, I don't think you can exclude the possibility that people at a senior level in the British system might even have authorised some collusion relating to the Dublin Monaghan bombings.
That talk of a total withdrawal from Northern Ireland prompted fears of a united Ireland and a soft approach to the IRA. Could this have motivated not only Loyalists but British security forces to act on a scale never before seen on this island?
So Loyalists had been bombing the south since 1969, and by 1972 those bombings had become deadlier. But what was remarkable, of course, and horrific about the May 74 bombings was the sheer scale of them, that they were three car bombs and that they were very coordinated and synchronised in Dublin, and then that also later on there was another bomb in Monaghan. So the level of destruction was huge. Did the people who planted those bombs realise that they would be, in their terms, so successful? It's very hard to tell because the previous bombings had not been at all on that scale. But these bombs went off at rush hour. They went off in the midst of a bus strike when thousands of people on a Friday evening were heading home, and in very, very crowded parts of Dublin city centre. So their effects were devastating. They certainly meet, you know, if you want to talk about terrorism, this is certainly terrorism, a civilian population being massacred in a capital city on a Friday evening. And the public reaction of some Loyalists is satisfaction. So I think it's a UDA spokesman says, we're at war with the Free State and we're laughing at them. They come just a few days into the UWC strike. So you can see them very clearly as an effort by the Loyalists to warn Dublin that not only can we bring Northern Ireland to a halt, but we can devastate your capital city as well. But of course, this was still on a much bigger scale than anything that had gone before.
I was horrified, shocked. Nothing on that scale. From an early stage, it became clear that there would be significant casualties. But there was nothing for people like me to do at that stage. It was a Gorda matter, a Department of Justice matter. And we had no idea what had happened. I mean, we had no idea, was it Loyalist? Was it IRA? What it was. It was only subsequently it began to emerge that it did not involve the IRA, that it involved the UVF or other paramilitary Loyalist organisations, and it was only later again that the issue of collusion arose.
I would therefore request you to report immediately to the Gardaí any suspicious or unusual movements object or motor vehicle. What has happened today will help to underline the criminal folly and utter futility of violent action as a means for furthering political aims.
Taoiseach Liam Cosgrave promised a major investigation. Loyalist paramilitaries were quickly identified as the perpetrators. But what families weren't to know is how that investigation would last just a few weeks. Nobody charged, despite knowledge amongst authorities on both sides of the border on who exactly had destroyed so many lives on May 17th, 1974.
I'm Colin Wallace, and in the 1970s I was the Senior Information Officer at Army Headquarters in Northern Ireland. I had a list of suspects by, I would think, within 3-4 days of the people we believed were involved. And that was a fairly comprehensive list.